It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's do it.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, you know that saying that truth is stranger than fiction. Well, truth is stranger than fiction. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. I was recording something the other day and said Thoroughly Thursday. No, it's not Thoroughly Thursday. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And I'll explain in a moment why I say the truth is stranger than fiction on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. But first, let me give you the number to call again, 866-348-7884. You want to give my voice a rest today? Let's hear from the maximum number of listeners we can with good Jewish-related questions, Israel-related questions, Hebrew-related questions, Old Testament, Messianic prophecy kind of focus questions, Jewish background to the New Testament kind of questions, questions even about Islam, although I'm less expert in Islam than other areas, we do have a good amount of information that we can help you with. So give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH. So Sunday, I learned first on social media about the horrific bomb blast in Pakistan. The majority of those killed, or a large number of those killed, were children. They were targeted. The Taliban, a splinter group from the Taliban in Pakistan, claimed responsibility, said they were targeting Christians. It was Easter Sunday, and even though Christians in Pakistan are a very small minority, and according to Open Doors Ministries, Brother Andrew's ministry there that helps the persecuted church, they say that persecution is extreme against Christians there. There may be some parts of Pakistan where the Christian and Muslim neighbors have better relations and maybe where the Muslims are more nominal. In any case, the park was filled, as you know, the Christians mainly in the park, especially in the park on Easter Sunday and in that particular neighborhood. And the suicide bomber detonates himself near children playing on swings and just horrific. And life goes on for most of us the same because, you know, we're not there. We don't know the people. But, of course, for the people involved, the rest of their lives have been terribly scarred. And large holes have been taken out of families that can never be filled again in this world. So I posted some things about it and mentioned radical Islam. And a couple of Pakistanis began to post on my Facebook page. And one of them said, thank God I found this page, and this is not real Islam, and these are not Muslims, and we get along great with the Christians, and we all have wonderful relations, etc. I don't think this person was intentionally lying. I think they had no clue what they were saying. In other words, they're probably a nominal Muslim, and they have friends with Christians and others, and it's fairly nominal, and it's everybody gets along just fine. And that's where she lives. But throughout the rest of the country, that's not the case. And of course, the Taliban are Muslims. And of course, many in Pakistan are strongly Muslim and even radically Muslim. Then another woman begins to post, and she says the same thing, another Pakistani woman. But she takes it further. And I have seen this over and over again. Are you ready? Are you ready? The Taliban are not real Muslims. No, they are actually the creation of Zionist organizations. They are actually the creation of Jewish organizations. And not long after I posted that absurd statement, a gentleman on Twitter contacts me and said, what do I tell my high school son? His friend in school is saying that the head of ISIS is a Jew. Oh, yeah, and you can get online and find it. Yeah, he's trained by Mossad and raised by Jewish parents. Of course, we know who he is. We know his career, his background, Iraqi Muslim. But this stuff is out there. Anti-Semitic insanity. But people believe it.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown, 866-348-7884. Let's go to the phones, starting with Jeff in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Now, as far as the church bombing in Pakistan, here is my personal thoughts on this, which is church security. Now,
It wasn't a church. It wasn't at a church. It was in a park.
Oh, in a park. Oh, wow. Well,
it was in a park.
I didn't know that. But in any event, this stuff is going to be coming to America. And I recently went to a church conference on church security. And here is a contribution I'm going to make to the program, which is I believe the trend will be an increase in church security, particularly armed security, to protect churches. And you already see this in some places in the Middle East, Iraq and places like that. I'm telling you something, believers really don't believe, a lot of them don't believe this stuff. They don't think it's going to happen in America. And exactly what's happening in Pakistan and other places will come here to America. Church bombing, suicide bombing, crazy stuff.
Yeah, if we allow it to, those things will happen. Certainly we see rising pressure against Christians from groups that are coming against us in the courts and coming against us in other ways, ideologically and through the media, but not with physical attack. But the groups that do engage in physical attack, the radical Muslim suicide bombers and things like that, yeah, they would do it wherever they could. They would do it every day all over the place if they could.
Exactly.
There's obviously security to a certain extent. I'll tell you this, Jeff. It's a different world than when I got saved and, you know, walking in and out of a church building or any building, the last thing you were thinking was security. I mean, you weren't going through metal detectors when you were getting on a plane back then, you know, 40-something years ago. And my wife and I were talking about, you know, we know kids today, talking with some of our grandkids, and there's fear of terrorism. Whereas we really grew up without that. My wife and I now, 61 years old, we grew up without that. But interestingly, increasingly, when I travel in churches, especially mega churches, folks will tell me, by the way, you know, someone picking me up in the airport is with the police. They'll say, by the way, we're part of this church security team. Or you just have a volunteer policeman in the building and things like that. But it's certainly wisdom these days. It is certainly wisdom. Thank you. Thank you for the call. 866-348-7884. We go to Rockaway, New Jersey. Jonathan, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Michael Brown. My question is in regards to Jesus and his baptism. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. My understanding is that Jesus, as a representative of his people, Jew and Gentile alike, he had to be baptized because when a Gentile came to faith in Judaism, that was one of the requirements of that particular law. Maybe just comment on that, please.
Yeah, it's a good question as to what the Lord meant when he said, allow it to be so, to John the Immerser, for we have to fulfill all righteousness. And it could be in keeping with his mentality that he is fulfilling the law and the prophets, that so as the representative of Israel, he is now being immersed, or it could be as the rite of passage. Obviously, he didn't need to do it for forgiveness of sins. That's why John was asking him. But as a representative of Israel, ultimately, he's going to die for the sins of Israel. Could that be what he was saying? That's certainly a common argument that many interpreters have. If it's either that or as kind of the rite of passage to identify in that way before beginning to his active ministry. But it seems he's doing it on some level in identification with the people of Israel.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your show.
Yes, sir. Thank you. 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish answers. More of the insanity of anti-Semitism. There's a neo-Nazi who is a Donald Trump supporter. Donald Trump is not a neo-Nazi. This is a crazy supporter, all right? He could be a supporter of anybody. That's not the issue. I'm just saying how he came to be known is as a Trump supporter. So obviously, if Trump knew this guy, he'd renounce this. All right. He's a neo-Nazi Trump supporter. He has called for the execution of Ted Cruz's wife because of her links to, quote, Jew banksters. Banksters, In other words, banks and the people who run the banks. Because his wife is connected to Jewish bankers, which he calls banksters, she should be killed. I mean, this is the sick stuff out there. Now he has apparently crossed a line, and he could be prosecuted for this, and he could regret these idiotic words that he has spoken. But I cannot tell you how often I run into this kind of trash. How often I'm spotting this on social media, just on our own accounts. This extraordinary level of believing anything when it comes to the Jewish people. This extraordinary level of embracing all kinds of crazy conspiratorial information. And then, to make matters worse, people not only believe it, they now caricature Jews because of it. And now it's time to get those dirty Jews. So is there any group in the world more hated than ISIS today? Well, I don't think so. Universally hated around the world and, of course, admired by crazy extremist Muslims. Any group more hated than ISIS? No. Well, who's behind it? The Jews. And Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS. Oh, he's actually born of Jewish parents and trained by Mossad. He's been trained by the Israeli security. It's nonsense, 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 100% false. You might as well say that Elvis Presley is the leader of ISIS. But so no, I saw it online. Oh, there's all kinds of evidence. It's just nonsense. So there's a good article in Haaretz, Israeli left-wing newspaper from November 17th of last year. Who is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? The Iraqi-born ISIS leader, a scholar who spent 4 years in U.S. captivity, uses Islamic law to justify his ruthlessness, but he still enjoys soccer and fancy watches. So here's the background. Born Ibrahim Awad Ibrahim al-Badri al-Samari in 1971 in the Iraqi city of Samarra, he grew up in a devout, lower-middle-class family that claimed to be able to trace its lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad. Remembered as quiet, reserved, and pious from an early age, al-Baghdadi was never outstandingly academic. He taught the Quran as a teenager to the neighborhood's children, went on to preach at Samarra's Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal Mosque. At university, he joined the Muslim Brotherhood, by this time living with his first wife in Baghdad's town down at Heel Tabshi neighborhood. He taught at the local mosque. Became known for his soccer skills while at the mosque there. He soon proved too radical for the Muslim Brotherhood. Following the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq 2003, helped found a militant group, Jaish al-Sunnah wal-Jama, the Army of the Sunni People, which drew its support from the so-called Sunni Triangle area. February 2004, he was arrested by U.S. forces in Fallujah and spent 4 years in the Camp Buka prison in southern Iraq, where he met many former Ba'athists who later became part of his insurgency. So these were part of the Saddam Hussein party, as I understand it. He was released in 2009, and according to guards at the prison, his parting words were, "I'll see you guys in New York." So, I mean, this guy's a radical. We know his background. We know his history. There's nothing mysterious here. Oh, no, but see, that's all a cover-up because he's a Jew. People will believe almost anything. So I'm going to give you some more examples of it today, of the insanity of anti-Semitism, the stuff that's out there. We'll answer your Jewish-related questions as well. 866-348-7884. The number to call. Oh, I've barely mentioned this entire week, but I don't want to let today go by. I can't let Thursday go by. We have a thoroughly Jewish special resource offer this week. Did I say resource? Resource. We have a thoroughly Jewish special resource offer this week. And it's three of our best resources at a tremendously low price. My book, The Real Kosher Jesus, The Mysterious Prophecy of Isaiah 53, and, oh yeah, the DVD episode is Christianity Jewish, only $30, postage paid for the whole package. So call or order 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978, or just go online, ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, your Thoroughly Jewish host, Michael Brown. Boy, I'm getting my tongue tied a little bit today. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. Are you Jewish? Did you hear weird things growing up that people thought this and that about the Jews? Or today you run into it, they believe all kinds of crazy things about the Jews, about Israel. Have you run into that? Curious what you've heard. Maybe just as a Christian or a secular person, you've heard all kinds of odd rumors and odd reports and crazy theories. And sometimes there's enough truth mixed in with an incredible amount of error that people could actually think, oh, there's something to it. For example, Jews control all the money in the world. Well, you have significant Jewish bankers, and you'll have people like, you know, the head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan or someone like that, you know, Jewish person. And, you know, you'll have some influential Jews in the finances. It's true. They do control all the money. Oh, yeah. Well, just tell that to all the banks around the world that are not Jewish owned and that are not Jewish operated. And then tell it to the Jewish people through history when they've often been oppressed and outcast in the societies in which they lived. And very, very poor. Remember the Fiddler on the Roof? That's how many Jews lived for centuries in poverty. You say, well, wasn't God blessing them? Well, the issue is, in many countries where they were not allowed to have normal jobs. Many of the, quote, Christian countries in which they lived, they were not allowed to have normal jobs. And sometimes the one job they could hold was the job of being money changers or money handlers. So they would give loans and things like that, and that would be the best way to make a living. Well, if you owe money to Jews, you're not necessarily going to like Jews. And during the Crusades, the Crusader armies marching through Europe, in a number of cases, turned on their Jewish neighbors as a good way to eliminate their debt. Kill a Christ killer if the person won't be baptized, and eliminate a debt at the same time. Oh, the Jews control all the world media. Well, you have some high-level Jews in media. You do. In other words, Jewish people have been very influential, for better or for worse. It's part of our DNA, part of our calling in God. There were Jewish leaders that sparked the communist movement. There are Jewish leaders that have been involved in revolutionary movements. But the vast, vast majority of power, of control, of authority around the world, the vast, vast, vast majority has nothing to do with Jews. But people believe these things, and then Jews get demonized in the process. Let's go to clip number 12. This is BBC Radio London, and a caller named Steve has some interesting ideas. By the way, if you believe these things, if you actually believe that Jews control the world money and Jews control the world media and Jews are guilty of this and Jews are guilty of that, oh, give me a call. We'll have a discussion. Let's see where the facts go. 866-348-7884. Listen to this call, clip number 12.
First of all, I'd like to say I don't believe all these numbers of people are being radicalised. This is all propaganda. The second thing I'd like to say is no way in the world could they have got all these facts and figures so quickly. You know, like names, oh, they're brothers, oh, they came from here. This is a terrorist false flag. Anyone who knows about false flags will know that these covert operations involve Israel's Mossad, the CIA and MI5 to blame other countries for their agenda in the Middle East. And this is what's going on time and time again. And people are waking up. You're not fooling all of us. The Zionists out there that are doing all this, they want to blame a certain section of people to achieve their agenda of taking over the Middle East, placing their governments that they want to nick oil to so-called Democrat, to make them Democrats so they can trade with them at a later date. And this is what it's all about.
Well, there you heard it. There you. That's what it's all about. Now you've got the facts. So when they say that their brother's involved in terrorist act, no. How could you find that out, that there were two brothers involved in terrorist acts in Brussels? No, of course not. And this is Mossad. This is Israeli intelligence. And this is other British intelligence. It's and Jews are behind these things. And there are not that many people being radicalized. Evil Israel. Not evil radical Islam, evil Israel or evil conspiracy, and it's caller after caller that or other callers will call in, and some have said that BBC Radio London provides a platform for conspiracy theories. So here's the response of the host. But let me just read a couple of quotes from that last call. Anyone who knows about false flags will know that these covert operations include Israel's Mossad, the CIA, and MI5 to blame other countries for their agenda in the Middle East. And this is what's going on time and time again. Those Zionists out there that are doing all this, they want to blame certain sections of people to achieve their agenda of taking over the Middle East. That's what this guy actually believes. Now, here's the host response, clip number 13.
Well, they're pretty contentious views, Steve, but do you smell a conspiracy then? You smell that intelligence is already there and it's not been acted upon? I mean, we already know that Brussels is being blamed for knowing enough about at least two of those who attacked Brussels and didn't perhaps act quick enough.
Yeah, contentious views. I understand he's a Brit, but come on, you got to be kidding me. But look, here's what I'm looking at. Let's see. I have a video on our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, ASK Dr. Brown, on YouTube. Posted a few new videos this week. Check them out. And it's the truth about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And here's what someone posted there. The criminal Zionist state of today, which is a state sponsor of terrorism, has nothing in common with the Israel of the Bible. The reason why the number of Christian Palestinians is decreasing in Palestine is because the Zionist state is carrying out ethnic cleansing against them. That is a bold-faced, ugly, discriminatory, racist lie. An anti-Semitic lie. Simple. End of subject. That's what it is. But if I've seen that once, I've seen it 1,000 times. And trust me, I've seen it more than once. And the countless times I've seen it, the countless times... Here are the exact words from a Pakistani Muslim posted to me on Sunday after the attack there. This is done by brainwashed people. The fake Taliban created by Jewish secret organizations. People believe that. Let's get the truth out about the Jewish people in Israel.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. Your Jewish-related questions, we're taking your Israel-related questions, we are taking today on the broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. Just some recent important news from Israel. Oh, hang on, that's not the file I was looking at. Let me go. All right, I'll find it in a moment. But please understand that when you see a rise in extremist Islamic terrorism within days, the horrific attacks in Brussels and in Pakistan, I mean, just mind-boggling evil, that many people tend to realize, the more sane people tend to realize that this is what Israel deals with all the time. And sometimes we'll become more sympathetic and sometimes even willing to learn from Israel. When you see Iran raising its head and pursuing nuclear capabilities, you find countries like Saudi Arabia saying, hey, you know, we should stand with Israel to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons because they understand the dangers involved. Interestingly, on a totally different note, the UN, which constantly bashes Israel, has turned to Israel for advice on inclusion of disabled. Seeking insights in inclusion, the UN has turned to Beit Issi Shapiro, a leading Israeli facility that was awarded special consultative status to the UN's Economic and Social Council in 2012. Let's see, Benjima Orr, the organization's Global Resource Development Director, addressed a UN conference days ago on World Down Syndrome Day on the topic of changing attitudes as leverage for social inclusion. He reviewed the facility's extensive research on attitude change and the different innovations created to promote inclusion within all age groups. And I was completely unaware of this. One of these is Friendship Park, Israel's first inclusive and accessible playground for children with and without disabilities, which serves as a model for similar projects worldwide and was established with the support of Let All the Children Play, an organization that also presented materials at the conference. Interesting. Interesting, isn't that? That the UN is looking to Israel for guidance on inclusion of the disabled. All right, we go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Norman, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, sir. I have a question for you. I've been wondering for all my life about Jewish. Why is it so hard for the Jewish people to accept Jesus as the Savior?
Ah, well, there are many reasons, sir. First, he's looked at as the founder of a different religion. Just like Christians know that they don't believe in Muhammad and they don't read the Quran because that's a different religion. So Jews know that they're supposed to be Jewish. Jews know that God called, especially if you're a religious Jew, that God called you as a Jew to be a Jew. So many Jews understand if they believe in Jesus, then they betray their people and they join another religion. That's how they see it. Also, through church history, the church has often mistreated the Jewish people. The church has often persecuted Jewish people. And Jews think that's just Christianity. They can't recognize those are false Christians or church leaders are false Christians or hypocritical Christians. So they've gotten a bad understanding of who Jesus is. They think that the church has been their enemy. Some even connect Christianity to the Holocaust. And they are waiting for the Messiah to come and establish peace on the earth. They say Jesus didn't do that, therefore he can't be the Messiah. And in their mind, they are betraying their people and going to another religion. That's why we have to show them that Jesus, the Jew, came as the Jewish Messiah and that it's Jewish to believe in him. Go to my website, realmessiah.com, for a lot more information.
Fire we want, for fire we please. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related questions you have, I'd love to help you. So fascinating, Norman in Charlotte. Again, the website where you will find a short list of the 100-plus most common Jewish objections to Jesus with our answers, and then with references to where you can get the full answers. That's realmessiah.com. That's our Jewish outreach website. We still have more materials to add, but the section on objections is full. So you go there and you say, you can just read the objections. Well, Jews don't believe in Jesus. Well, I was born a Jew, I'll die a Jew. Well, the Messiah is going to bring peace on earth. We don't need human sacrifice. Your God is three. We believe in one. And on and on. And then you'll see our answer to that, not a full answer, but a clear, succinct answer. And then if you want the full answer, where you can get that. I have a 5-volume series on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. Answering Jewish objections to Jesus. Over 1,500 pages, and we answer all of the questions there in depth, in a comprehensive way. Thankfully, God's grace has been on these volumes to touch many Jewish lives and help Jewish people come into the kingdom and help Jewish believers be strengthened in their faith, and some who had fallen away come back to the Lord. But the most fundamental thing for Norman to understand and other Christians to understand is, for a Jew, faith in Jesus is like a Christian believing in Muhammad and the Quran. In other words, it's completely outside the sphere and scope of his faith. Most Jews have never considered Jesus as a Messiah. If you grew up in a religious home, you certainly haven't considered him unless God's worked sovereignly in your life with contacts, people on the outside, or other things like that. And if you're more secular, nominal Jew, as most Jews are in America, still Jesus is considered different and not for us as Jews, and a whole different system of faith, and then many other objections that come up along the way. That's why for many years we have spent time to put these resources together, and then tons of hours of free resources. On my YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown, you can watch a 32-week series. We've aired this on TV the last couple of years, a 32-week series on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. So about 16 hours of teaching, so 32 half-hour lectures, just on my YouTube channel. Scroll down, you'll find it, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown. All right, we go to Brockton, Massachusetts. Nicole, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have two questions, but we'll start with the first one and see how much time you have to answer my
question. I like that. If you have two questions, we'll start with the first. Let's do it. I like that.
So I would like to know, what is the difference between someone being called Jewish, Hebrew, and Israelite?
Okay. There's some overlap, but there are differences. So Israelite is the way of speaking of an ancient Israelite. Someone who is part of the 12 tribes of Israel would be an Israelite. David was an Israelite. Isaiah was an Israelite. All right, Moses would have been an early Israelite. So someone who is part of the 12 tribes of Israel, identified on a national level, is an Israelite. You would speak of someone today who lives in Israel or who was born in Israel as an Israeli, okay? You wouldn't refer to them as an Israelite today. I was in Korea one time, and my translator, each time in Korea, my first few trips, we had these sovereign meetings with Jews or Israelis in Korea. It was absolutely wild. And on one of the trips, my interpreter calls my phone in the hotel. It was on a Sunday morning, and we hadn't left yet. He had gotten up early, he'd gone for breakfast, and he calls me, says, "I just met an Israelite! I just met an Israelite on the elevator." I'm thinking, an Israelite? David or Elijah or something like that? He meant Israeli. Okay, now, Jew is much more generic now. Initially, Jew referred specifically, a Judean, to someone who was of the kingdom of Judah or the southern tribe of Judah when there was a split between the northern tribes and the southern. But by New Testament times and before that, Jew was just a synonym for all the people of Israel. So when we say a Jew today, we are speaking of anyone who is part of the people of Israel, the children of Israel. Doesn't matter where you were born, doesn't matter where you live. A Jew is the larger term. Initially, it referred to the people of Judea or the people of the tribe of Judah. But ultimately, it refers now to anyone that's of the people of Israel. So in that sense, very closely synonymous. Israel, speaking of the people as a whole, or the modern state of Israel. Israelite, speaking of an ancient part of the people of Israel. Israeli, speaking of a modern part of the state, the nation of Israel. And then Jew, just being a generic way to speak of these people worldwide. It'd be the most generic way to speak of us. For some, it means, in particular, a practitioner of Judaism. And I've had religious Jews tell me, well, you're not a Jew, because I don't follow all the Jewish traditions. So they tell me I'm not a Jew. In their mind, that is someone who practices Judaism. But in fact, the way the term is used, it's both religious and ethnic. So you can be an atheist Jew. You can be a Buddhist Jew. You can be a Muslim Jew, and you're still a Jew, okay? Because that's how you're born. That's who you are. Now, lastly, Hebrew, we don't use it as much. It is a term that was used in the Old Testament. Paul referred to himself as a Hebrew of Hebrews in the New Testament. That obviously has more of an emphasis on ethnicity than practice, because the people were called the Hebrews. And there's debate as to what that term actually goes back to. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, in the Old Testament, it's normally a way that someone is designated to outsiders. So Jonah is known as a Hebrew to the Gentiles on the ship, to the outsiders. But we just don't know the origin of the term. There's different arguments. Some say it's from the word to pass over. It's because Abram and his ancestors passed over, went from one country to another, or passed over the river. And then others say it goes back to these ancient Near Eastern groups called Habiru or Hapiru, and that it's related in this particular group that then became known for that. We don't know for sure, but we know over a period of time it was very similar to saying an Israelite, a Hebrew or an Israelite would be very similar. So Hebrew and Jew, there's overlap, and they can be used synonymously, but most people don't use Hebrew as much. Jew is the common term.
Mm-hmm. Wow, thank you. That was very thorough. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And the reason, I hate to be so thorough in that respect, but because it's a matter of nuances, I'm trying to communicate them. All right, so question number two.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
The second question that I have has to do with attending a Messianic congregation. I am not of any Jewish descent, but mm-hmm. I have been really drawn to attending a Messianic congregation. I've celebrated Passover a couple of times with the Messianic congregation here in Massachusetts. And I just wanted to know what your opinion was on a non-Jewish believer in Christ attending a Messianic congregation.
Well, I think it's great if you feel at home there. In fact, in most cities in America where you have Messianic congregations, they're mainly Gentile. There's a smaller amount of Jews than Gentiles, interestingly. Unless it's a heavily Jewish area, then it would be different. So it's very common because the church in many ways has moved so far away from its Jewish roots. The church has moved so far away from the biblical calendar.
Right.
The church often doesn't recognize the Jewish background to aspects of the New Testament. So many Gentile believers really enjoy being part of a Messianic congregation because there's no mandate in the New Testament that everyone must worship on Sunday or celebrate Sunday as the Sabbath. Well, why mm-hmm. not? Why not celebrate the Sabbath with the Jewish people on Saturday? Many times, Messianic congregations are stronger in teaching, so people who like teaching will go there. The key thing is, the danger is that you do not get caught up in a false Jewish identity. What is central is Yeshua, Jesus Yeshua, and our relationship with him, not a Jewish identity or not Jewish tradition, not a Jewish calendar. So to the extent the Messianic congregation is really Yeshua-centric and really worships the Lord and really teaches things that are holistic and not simply, you know, a Jewish teaching on this interesting subject. In other words, they've got to really teach the scriptures and build people up. Then great. Why not? There are Jews in churches. Why not Gentiles and Messianic congregations? I have a book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. I think you'll find that really helpful. The last couple of sections of that book should be really helpful. And the first sections will answer some of your earlier questions, your first question. All right, God bless you, Nicole.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. We go to our friend Ron in Ontario. How you doing today, man?
Hey, bud. How you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing very well, thanks. Just getting over this fluid buildup because of bad allergies and things, but I think I'm on the other side of it now.
Yeah, you were telling us yesterday that you were going through this stuff this time of the year down there.
Yeah, just, you know, the thing is, once you know what you're dealing with, then, when you're experiencing something that's unusual and you're feeling just run down all the time, because I'm normally vibrant, overflowing with energy, and thankfully with healthy lifestyle, I'm just charged. And so when something's just not right and you don't know what it is, trying to figure that out, you know, you're praying for a breakthrough. So once understood what we were dealing with, that, okay, so it's not pleasant, but at least we know what it is. Little by little, we get stronger. And the big thing is, as long as it does not hurt the radio broadcast, as long as my voice is here, I'm here. So we're good, man. Thank you, though, Ron.
Well, you're looking terrific, Dr. Brown. You really are. That weight loss just made you look really, really good.
Got it. Well, how can I help today?
Well, okay. I'm considering preparing a message for a church group, and the message has to do with should the Christians, the Gentiles, or Messianic Jews, should they approach Jewish people? Are they commanded? I guess that's the word. Are they commanded by the Lord to approach Jewish people, to teach them how to become a believer in a methodical, analytical way, and I'm not sure I'm on solid biblical ground by approaching this subject, and I wanted to know from you, am I in solid biblical ground, and are there scriptures to validate, that I am on this, that I am on solid ground? So I just wanted to ask you that.
Yeah, well, here's the way we approach it. We are commanded to go and make disciples, right? So as disciples, we are commanded to go and make disciples, and we are called to be ambassadors and share the message of reconciliation with as many people as we can. So in that respect, no, I'm not commanded to talk to every human being I meet. You know, I'm walking through the airport, I have to try to stop every person. I get on a bus, I have to stand up and preach to every person. No, we need to look to be fishers of men. We have to be wise. So we need to look for the right opportunities to share the gospel. So I would put it like this. Number one, we should be looking for every opportunity to share the good news of the Messiah, to tell people about Jesus, be they Jew or Gentile. We should look for every opportunity to do it. We're called to be ambassadors of reconciliation. People are lost without the good news. We have the good news. And the biblical principle is to the Jew first. So I would encourage everyone to pray for opportunities. Lord, use me to share my testimony. Use me to share the scriptures. Use me to reach out to someone that doesn't know you. give me a divine appointment. Give me wisdom. Give me an open door. It could be a neighbor that you find out is sick. What an opportunity to go there and share the love of God and see if they have a need and offer to pray for them because you care for them. And in particular, if you have an opportunity to do that for a Jewish person, all the more, because the gospel is to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. So the general principle, yes, we do our best to reach out to everyone with the good news. But look at it as a calling as opposed to a command. Yes, it is. The Great Commission is not a suggestion. But you don't want people to do this out of legalistic pressure. You want them to do it knowing this is a sacred obligation I have from the Lord. And it's an opportunity that I have. Right?
I wanted to ask you, am I okay with even delivering this message? Is it a message that I should even be... doing?
If you can do it in a way that is love-based and love-motivated as opposed to simply a command or anything that would be done out of fear or legalistic pressure, then yes, it's great to do. How wonderful it is to share the good news. What a great opportunity. What a sacred privilege we have. If someone didn't talk to me, I never would have known about the Messiah. And many people are afraid to talk to Jewish people. No, let them know that most Jews come to faith through the witness of a non-Jew in North America, or at least in America, because of just the logistics of being so many more Christians. But I would make sure that you have God's heart in it. Don't just let it be an intellectual thing, Ron, or a biblical truth, but let it be that you have God's heart, a real love to see Jews and Gentiles come to Jesus the Messiah. And then from there, hey, the gospel is to the Jew first. So let's pray for opportunities to bring the gospel to Jewish people. Hey, Ron, thanks as always. Always good to talk to you. May the Lord's grace flood your heart and may he use you to make a difference. Hey, thanks again. Ron's testimony is one we remember well, his 97-year-old mother coming to faith in the nursing home, the thing that turned her was my book, The Real Kosher Jesus. That's our resource offer this week, part of our special resource offer. So, Ron in Ontario, I always remember. We go to Lincoln, Rhode Island. Caesar, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Brown, and God bless you. So my question is that with the Jewish people, since they denied Jesus and didn't accept him as their Messiah, are they still waiting for a Messiah to come?
Yes, sir. Religious Jews are fervently waiting for the Messiah to come. They are praying daily for the coming of the Messiah. They are longing for his coming. They are mourning because he has not yet come. They many times believe that in every generation there's a potential Messiah, a Jewish leader that could be raised up as the Messiah. If the people are ready. So they are trying to keep the commandments diligently and get more and more Jews to follow the traditions to hasten the coming of the Messiah. Those are the religious Jews, which make up, say, 10% of the world Jewish population. The less religious Jews, most of them believe that there's a Messiah coming. In other words, they say, yeah, Christians believe the Messiah already came. We still believe he's going to come. There's not a depth of belief with that. There are some very liberal Jews who, you know, are atheistic and don't even believe in a Messiah, or they believe in Judaism as like the religion of the people in some way, and there for social justice and honoring God in that way. But they don't believe in a personal Messiah. So some Jews, you know, they're just totally secular. They don't believe anything in this regard. Some are very liberal, and they think, yeah, there's going to be like an improvement of the human race in a messianic era, but we're going to bring that about. And then religious Jews are fervently praying and waiting for the coming of the Messiah, not to die for our sins on the cross, but to bring all of the Jewish people into obedience to God, to fully restore the nation of Israel, and to bring peace on the earth, which, of course, Jesus will do when he returns. My bottom line today, let us join with Jewish people praying for the coming of the Messiah and say, God, open their eyes to the Messiah who has already come. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's do it.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So I'm looking at these assorted comments, online comments, posted on YouTube, posted elsewhere. The Jews guilty of this, the Jews guilty of that, the Jews control this, the Jews control that. And the scary thing is that people actually believe this. I'm looking at a post from a woman in Pakistan this past Sunday, interacting on my Facebook page. And she wanted me to know Muslims and Christians in Pakistan get along just great. The Christians there are very happy. No clue whatsoever, it seemed, of the persecution of Christians throughout Pakistan, judged extreme by Open Doors. And as for the Taliban and Muslim radicals, what did she say? Jews created those mind-washed terrorists and name them as Muslims. It's just a game to point out Islam and Muslims, but they are not true Muslims. They are brainwashed, created by Jews. They falsely say the name of Allah because it has been fitted in their minds by Jews. Yeah, that's what she... I appealed to her to pull back. I urged her to drop this stuff. I said, because you can't post this on our Facebook page. We will not have that. And she said, no, it's true. 866-34-TRUTH. That is 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question you have, we had some interesting questions the first hour. Any Jewish-related question, Hebrew-related question, Jewish roots-related question, Israel-related question, even Islamic question, we'll do our best to give you solid, informative answers. And even if your question is kind of far out there, if it's Jewish-related, we will take it. I've got a video up and an article, The Truth About Radical Islam. Someone posted in response to that. And this is after, this was posted after the Pakistan Easter bombing, targeting Christians, in particular children. Quote, Islam is religion of peace. That's true. Israel is evil, I think they meant to say, occupier of the land of Islam. That's what they post after the terrorist bombings. How about this? Jew, same one, their English obviously broken. Jew, Masonic, always stupid. They want to teach us false prophecy or fiction made up by Zionists. Jesus is not Jewish. Jews aren't Semitic people. They are European and Khazar. Dr. Brown, we are waiting for an apology. The killing of Jesus from Jews. But we are not waiting for you to preach to us. This was all the same person posting these things. Oh, how about this one? We have a video up about the truth about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I can't even read the name of the person who posted this. Let's just say it would be a big house of prostitution and then the name Israel. Zionist brown liar. And yes, keep the Zionist demolition of Palestinian houses going on, as well as the occupation of Palestinian lands for the racist F Zionist Israel? Question mark. Yeah. Which houses, Palestinian houses, have the Israelis demolished? The houses of the families of terrorists, not the people, but the families of terrorists, the houses where the terrorists were, those were demolished as a punishment for the terrorists doing what they did and the family's complicity. Not killing terrorist families and not destroying random Palestinian homes. But how is that reported? Israel, ethnic cleansing, killing Palestinians, destroying their homes. The lies are out there. Send it, Lord.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I was asked a question. I was asked a question last hour about Jews waiting for the Messiah to come. What's their view? And I explained that religious Jews are praying daily, fervently, confessing their faith in the coming of the Messiah, longing for him to come. It's deeply held in Jewish tradition and among religious Jews. Those words we just heard sung by Paul Wilbur are the words of the Ani Ma'amin, I believe, 13 fundamental confessions of faith made by a traditional Jew daily based on the writings of Moses Maimonides, who lived from roughly 1135 to 1204 and was an influential philosopher and codifier of law and scholar. So, yes, Jews confess that daily. Religious Jews pray for that daily. And I encourage you to join with Jewish people and say, God, make the Messiah known. Make the Messiah known. Open hearts, open minds to help Jewish people know that the one they're waiting for, the one they're longing for, has already come, but they didn't understand it. And our forefathers, by and large, didn't understand it. 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related questions you have, we'll get to in a little while. First, let me give you a Jewish insight from the scriptures, or I should say, a Jewish approach. Now, when a Jewish boy starts studying the Torah, normally with his father as his first teacher, otherwise in a traditional Jewish school, so he's a young boy, he's, I don't know, 5-6 years old, and reading the Hebrew and learning the text. And now as he's getting a little bit older, his father's teaching him, and he will be taught, a traditional Jew, will be taught to read the five books of Moses with the commentary of Rashi, which is an acronym for Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. And he is the foremost biblical and Talmudic commentator in Judaism, the Talmud being the vast compilation of Jewish law, tradition, folklore, interpretation, that was finally put in written form around the 6th century of this era, the larger of the two Talmuds being the Babylonian Talmud that was completed in its edited form around the 6th century. So the commentary of Rashi is on the Bible and on the Talmud. And Rashi lived from 1040 to 1105. So this is one of the very first things you'll learn as you're learning Torah, studying Torah with Rashi's commentary. And it's a fascinating read on Genesis 1. So most Christian translations will say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Most Jewish translations will say something like, in the beginning of God's creating of the heavens and the earth, and while the earth was formless and void, etc., then God said, let there be light. So this poses a question for traditional Jews. Why start here? Why start with creation? You say, well, that's totally logical. You start with creation because it's the beginning and it tells us how we got here and who's behind it and all that. Yeah, but if you're a traditional Jew, the main thing is the law. We're here to keep the law. So why don't we start with the first commandment? So this is Rashi's commentary that Jewish boys will learn at a fairly early age. Of course, not. They won't be able to understand all of it without a teacher. Said Rabbi Isaac, it was necessary to begin the Torah except from this month is to you, Exodus 12:2, which is the first commandment that the Israelites were commanded. Excuse me, it was not necessary to begin the Torah except from this month is to you, which is the first commandment that the Israelites were commanded. Exodus 12:2, this month to you is the beginning of months. This is when they're going to come out of Egypt, and God's going to give the Passover legislations. So these are the first laws that are given to the nation. So why not start the Torah there? Okay, here are the first laws. You can see how much the legal orientation is there. For the main purpose of the Torah is its commandments. And although several commandments are found in Genesis, for example, circumcision and the prohibition of eating of the thigh sinew, they could have been included together with the other commandments. Now, for what reason did he commence with in the beginning? Because of the verse, Psalm 111, verse 6, the strength of his works he related to his people to give them the inheritance of the nations. For if the nations of the world should say to Israel, you are robbers, for you conquered by force the lands of the seven nations of Canaan. This is written, friends, 1,000 years ago. They will reply, the entire earth belongs to the Holy One, blessed be He. He created it, this we learn from the story of creation, and gave it to whomever He deemed proper when He wished. He gave it to them, and when He wished, He took it away from them and gave it to us. Isn't that interesting? That's how Rashi's commentary begins. Why start with in the beginning? Why start with creation? Well, because God needs to tell the whole world that He's the creator, and He's the creator and the owner of the earth, and therefore He gives it to whom He wants, and He gives this territory to whom He wants, and He gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. And when other nations say, no, 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 that's all right, it belongs to us, He said, no. And look at what the accusation is going to be against Israel. Rashi wrote this 1,000 years ago. You are robbers, for you conquered by force the lands of the seven nations of Canaan. Now you're robbers. You're the evil occupiers in Israel. And the ultimate answer is that, hey, the earth is given into whoever's hands God wants, and He's the creator. And when He gave it to you, land of Canaan, when He wanted, and when it was done, and when He wished, He took it away, and He gave it to us, the Jewish people. That's how it starts. Interesting, isn't it? 866, I was going to grab a call. Let me stay right here. 866-348-7884. So I'm just going to do my best to make this intelligible. How do we understand? Now, Rashi gets into the actual words here in Genesis 1-1. How do we actually understand in the beginning of God's creation? That's how he is interpreting it. This verse calls for a midrashic interpretation, a homiletical interpretation, because the vowels are not what would have been expected. It teaches us that the sequence of the creation as written is impossible, as our rabbis state it. And then they open it up, starting with the letter B, which would be the second letter of the alphabet, rather than the letter A, which is the first letter of the alphabet, the Aleph. It's not the letter A, of course, but I'm speaking half English here. I'm trying to simplify this rather than read through all of it. Okay, in short, the grammar, the vocalization, the vowels, that they're not what would have been expected. So let's look at this homiletically, and let's look at Reshit beginning a little differently. And now let's understand it, that God created the world for the Reshit, the beginning, and the beginning, the Reshit, the principal part, is the Torah. So God created the world for the sake of the Torah. Homiletical explanation. He said, but if you wish to explain it according to its simple meaning, explain it thus. At the beginning of the creation of heaven and earth, the earth was astonishing with emptiness and darkness, and God said, let there be light. But Scripture did not come to teach the sequence of the creation, to say that these came first, for if it came to teach this, it would have been written at first with different Hebrew words, barishonah. He created the heavens and the earth. In other words, he's not giving you all of the chronology in these opening verses or the order, but rather saying, when God began to create the heaven and the earth, and here's where things stood, then, thereafter, he did this, he did this, he did this, he did this, and we have it in an ordered form, and he gets into a technical, grammatical discussion. Even though Rashi's comments are often very concise, here on the opening verse, he has a couple of pages. And then it says, God, Elohim, God. It doesn't say Yahweh, Lord. as we normally see it, or Lord God, Yahweh Elohim. It doesn't say that. Why does it just say God? He said it does not say the Lord's creation, Yahweh's creation, for in the beginning it was his intention to create it with the divine standard of justice, but he perceived that the world would not endure, so he preceded it with the divine standard of mercy, aligning it with the divine standard of justice, and that is the reason that is written on the day the Lord God made heaven and earth. Again, this is homiletical. His point is God just speaks of justice. So God was creating the world with justice, but he realized the world couldn't exist with justice alone. Hence, the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, speaks of justice and mercy, according to Rashi's commentary. Hey, it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We're getting into the Hebrew Scriptures.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us. 866-348-7884. This is Michael Brown, and I am delighted to be with you. In fact, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, let me grab another verse just to give you an idea of how a traditional Jew approaches the Scriptures in contrast with how a Christian would typically approach the Scriptures, all right? So I'm going to go over to Proverbs chapter 5, and it's a well-known passage in Proverbs warning about sexual immorality, okay? Well-known passage with strong warnings about sexual immorality. And my son, hearken to my wisdom, incline your ear to my understanding, to watch your thoughts and your lips shall guard knowledge, for the lips of a strange woman drip honey, and her palate is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, as sharp as a two-edged sword, her feet descend to death, her steps come near the grave, lest you weigh the path of life, her paths have wandered off, and you shall not know. And now, children, hearken to me. Do not turn away from the sayings of my mouth. Distance your house from her, and do not draw near to the entrance of her house, lest you give others your glory and your ears to a cruel one. And it goes on from there. So how does a traditional Jew understand this? Now, does a traditional Jew take seriously the warnings about sexual sin? Oh, yes, absolutely, of course. If you meet a very traditional Jewish rabbi, you're a woman, and you extend your hand for the rabbi to shake hands, in most cases, you will you will not get a handshake back. Why? Because you're not going to touch the hand of a woman that's not a relative. But not even a handshake, let alone a hug or a peck on the cheek. So yes, very high standards in terms of sexual purity and things like that. And if you walk through an ultra-Orthodox area in Israel, like Mea Shearim in Israel or B'nai Brak, first there'll be signs of telling you as women, you know, to dress properly, to dress modestly and things like that. And you could be escorted out if you're not dressed modestly by some of the people that would get upset. But let's say that you're dressed modestly for us, but not modestly enough for them. You'll see as the guys walk by, especially the young guys, they'll literally turn their head away and they'll walk with their head turned as they walk by, or they'll put their hand up to cover their eyes. So you can see very strong reactions. But notice how Rashi, again, foremost a commentary on the Bible for Jewish readers. He lived from 1040 to 1105. And one of the big three, as they're called, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and Radak. So Rashi is an acronym, is a French scholar, Jewish scholar, for Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, so Rabbi Solomon, son of Isaac. Ibn Ezra is short for Abraham Ibn Ezra. He was in the Spanish world and traveled to other countries as well. And then Radak, which is an acronym for Rabbi David Kimchi. His father was the famous Joseph Kimchi. When I first started reading these, I didn't reading in English about them because I couldn't read the Hebrew yet. I didn't realize it was Kimchi when I saw the name. It looked like kimchi to me. And I told this rabbi, I said, yeah, well, I read that Rabbi David Kimchi said this. He said, who are you talking about? I said, you don't know David Kimchi? I'm thinking, how ignorant can you be? He's like really famous, isn't he? He's one of the big three medieval Jewish commentaries. You don't know David Kimchi? He said, who are you talking about? I said, David Kimchi. He says, oh, Kimchi. He was so upset with me for mispronouncing the name. Oh, yeah, the Japanese scholar, David Kimchi. All right, so here's how Rashi understands the words. So the lips of a strange woman drip honey, and her palate is smoother than oil. So Rashi says, drip honey, an expression of sweetness. The lips of a strange woman, apostasy. In other words, this is a picture of everything that will pull you as a Jew away from Torah. So, lest you weigh the path of life, her paths have wandered off and you shall not know. Here is a midrashic, a homiletical interpretation. So did the sages expound it. So these were the rabbis from centuries earlier. The Holy One, blessed be he, moved away the reward for the commandments and did not explain the reward, so that a person should not see a commandment for which the reward is great and cling to it and leave over the other commandments. This is the interpretation. Lest you weigh the ways of the Torah, which one to take and which one to leave, therefore its paths wandered off. God caused them to wander off, and he did not make them known. This is homiletical tradition. But according to the sequence of the verses, since after it is written, and now, children, hearken to me, and do not turn away from the sayings of my mouth, distance your way from her. It appears that he has not yet ended the section dealing with the harlot, and it should be interpreted as follows. Do not weigh the path of life in conjunction with the strange one, saying what to do, whether this one or this one, whether to follow the path of life or the path of the strange woman. For the paths of the harlot have wandered off to the grave, and you will not know how to beware until you wander off and fall. Lest you give your glory to others, he interprets as, lest you turn your heart to other gods to give them the glory of your beauty and your praise and your years to accrue unto the prince of Gehinnom, from whence we get the term Gehenna. Lest strangers be sated with your strength. Those are the prophets of Baal, who collect money with their lies and their hastiness. And your labors, your toil with which you were saddened and fatigued in the house of an alien, in the pagan temple of the pagan. So he's seeing here, as other traditional Jewish interpreters do, he's seeing the picture of the harlot as the picture of the seduction of the world, the seduction of the flesh, the seduction of false religion away from obedience to the Torah and leading to apostasy. Now, again, it's not that they didn't understand. There is a literal focus here on the seductive ways of a woman. But as they're reading this as traditional Jews, the whole emphasis is Torah obedience, and what's going to take me away from obeying the Torah? It is these other forces. So drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own spring, verse 15. What's that talking about? It's talking about drink water in context. It's talking about be satisfied with your own wife. Be satisfied with your relationship with her. And don't drink from other wells and other sources. In other words, don't get involved in adultery. But Rashi, interpreting this in a Jewish traditional way, says this. Drink water from your own cistern, from the cistern that the Holy One, blessed be he, gave you for your share, namely the law of Moses. So the whole passage is interpreted as if it's an exhortation not to stray from obedience to the Torah. It's not so much an exhortation to look for the seductive ways of a woman trying to take you away from your wife. It's looking for the seductive things that will take you away from the Torah. This is Jewish Interpretation on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I'm having a little interaction here with Matt, my producer. So let me, and Joey, our engineer here. So we'll have a little fun here and bring you up to date. This is Michael Brown. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you have any Jewish-related question for me at all, Christians and the Law of Moses, Jewish people in Israel today, radical Islam because of its Middle Eastern origins, a Hebrew question, a Jewish religion question, my joy to take your calls at 866-348-7884. Earlier your call, the better chance I'll be able to get to your call. Okay. Every language has letters that and pronunciations that we're used to and ones we're not used to. So, for example, in Hebrew, ancient and today, you have a shh sound, right? Shalom, shh. In Greek, though, you didn't have a shh sound. So if you were Shaul in Hebrew, you would be more like Saul in Greek. Why? Because you don't have the shh sound in Greek. Now, what's funny is if you grow up without a particular sound, it's often hard to say it. It's often hard for you to say that sound if you didn't grow up with it. So when I was learning Arabic in college and then had some more in grad school, it was very difficult to pronounce some of the sounds because I never grew up with them. Ayin, deep guttural. Now, originally it was in Hebrew too, but it's not in modern Hebrew pronunciation. Or ayin, or sod and dod. And as I'm pronouncing them now, if you're an Arabic speaker, you're like, boy, that's bad. Yeah, I understand. Pronunciation was never my strong point. I learned to read and understand classical Arabic as opposed to speak modern Arabic. And then you have a three different H sounds. Three different H sounds. You have huh, just a letter H, right? Huh with a moderate guttural and huh with a harder guttural. So huh, huh, and huh. And they're very, very distinct. My second one wasn't quite as strong as it should have been because I'm trying to distinguish between the second and the third. If you're a German speaker, just you grew up in Germany, you've spoken German most of your life, say thanks a lot, thanks, thanks, thank you. Th, th, th. You don't have that th sound. You didn't grow up with it, did you? No, you didn't grow up with it. So, you know, what we say thanks, you say danke. So different sounds. So in Hebrew, there is a ch sound. The two that you have in Arabic, ch and ch, the softer and the harder, they were, and hey, where else on talk radio are you going to hear this than here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, right? So those two different sounds, they're now found in the same letter in Hebrew, but originally they were distinguished, okay? So when I was first reading about the names of rabbis and things, and as a new believer now reading different things because I didn't have that, I didn't have a traditional upbringing. I'd learned a little Hebrew from my bar mitzvah and so on. I didn't realize that anytime I saw CH in a Jewish name, like the holiday of Hanukkah, not Chanukah. Oh, we celebrate Chanukah. No. Chanukah. So I didn't know this. So I see David Kimchi, famous rabbi, lived in the 13th century. 12th, 13th century, David Kimchi. And I'm talking to a rabbi about it, and he does not know who I'm talking about. I'm thinking, everybody, you must know, you're a rabbi. He's a famous guy, isn't he? And then he realized, Kimchi. As I said the last segment, he got upset with me. Okay, so I was just, when I said he sounded Japanese, Kimchi. All right, so I've been corrected. I almost said Korean, but I don't remember what I thought back then, whether I thought Korean or Japanese. It just sounded like Oriental to me, all right? So yes, Kimchi is Korean. So in that respect, he sounded like a Korean rabbi. And all that information up to there was free just to get to the punchline. We'll be right back with your calls.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH. All right. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for all of the details of kimchi here. I really, really appreciate it. And if not for the fact that it was 30 Jewish Thursday, I'd read it all for the edification of our listening audience, but they'll just have to look it up on their own. But this is what my producer does for me, friends. If it seems like I know something, it's just because I'm fed information day and night. I do know some things. 866-348-7884 in Mechanicsville, Virginia. Wayne, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. Good to talk with you. I'm so grateful that I get to listen to a portion of your broadcast every afternoon on the way home. Be encouraged, my brother. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You have a question? Yeah, go ahead. Yes, great.
Yes, I do. I recently discovered six siblings through a genealogy research online. I discovered that I have a sister, Miriam, who lives in a suburb of Tel Aviv. My wife and I will be visiting the family next month. And I have seen your book online, 60 Questions, considering purchasing that resource. But I have to admit, there's some fear that I will be walking on eggshells. My family is traditional Jews, and they are not messianic. Mm-hmm. And, I'm trying to avoid any mind hits that might be out there.
Yeah, so do they know that you're a believer in Jesus?
Yes, they do. I have confessed to them of my belief and love for Yeshua the Messiah.
Got it. So while you're there with them, you don't want to push anything. You might think, oh, it's my opportunity, but that would actually be the most negative. You just want to be yourself. You want to be full of love and full of joy and enjoying the land, whatever information they can give you or anywhere they can take you or anywhere they can point you or things like that. You know, just spend time with them. Ask them about life in Israel. Just ask them a million questions like you would for, you know, relatives, friends that you haven't seen or haven't gotten close to, and make the most of your time there. And if they have questions for you, great. If they have questions for you, then, you know, you can answer honestly, but just answer in a sincere way as opposed to a pushy way. Well, how can you believe this? Oh, it's like this. And you know, do you know how much Christians in America love Israel, pray for the Jewish people or things like that? Let them know that reality. And you might find you have a lot in common. So the thing is, sometimes people feel a pressure. And when they're in Israel, they feel they have to do something because it's Israel and it's the Holy Land. And the best thing is just be yourself. Enjoy the trip. Enjoy the time with family and others. And as the Lord opens doors to share your faith, great, do it. The book I think would be more helpful to read is The Real Kosher Jesus. I think that would actually be more helpful. And that's one you can even bring with you. And just if something comes up, say, I've been reading this really interesting book where this Messianic Jewish scholar interacts with an Orthodox rabbi. And they may know who Rabbi Shmuel is. They may know his name. And it's a great tool to give to a Jewish person if they're willing to read it. We've had great fruit with our materials being read by Israelis. So that's the one I'd recommend, the Real Kosher Jesus. And by the way, not to sell you this resource offer, but we have it this week packaged with the Mysterious Prophecy of Isaiah 53 and then a TV show I did is Christianity Jewish. So if you go to our website, askdrbrown.org, you'll find those three resources packaged together.
I would love to have them. That would be timely as we're going the first week in May, and I so look forward to this. So much in agreement with everything you just said, Dr. Brown. My position will be one of reactive and not proactive in my beliefs, and I agree with you. If any questions come up, I am confident the Holy Spirit will prepare me.
Absolutely.
For times such as that.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So the smile of the Lord upon you, and may it be a life-changing trip. Do your best to rest adequately as you're going over there, because you have the time zone change and a little jet lag. Not everyone's used to that.
Yeah.
So the more you can rest in flight and then be ready, because once you're there, you know, it's a whole different world, and it's an amazing trip. All right, God's blessings on you. Thanks, Wayne.
God bless you, brother. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
All right, goodbye. 866-34-TRUTH. Raleigh, North Carolina, Elwood, welcome to Line of Fire.
Well, thank you, sir. Glad to be on your show today. And I want to know, the Jewish Bible, how does it compare to our Old Testament? Can I find a copy of it in English, and where can I buy a copy?
Sure. Okay, number one, in terms of the overall content, it's identical. In other words, the exact same books that we have, they're found in the Jewish Bible. That's number one. Number two, the order is different. They are divided up differently. They are not throughout, but in different parts, okay? So the five books of Moses, they're the same. They start the same five books of Moses, and then you go after that to Joshua and Judges. But you don't have Ruth next. You have 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. You do not have there 1 and 2 Chronicles. You do not have there Esther. So let me give you the short explanation for this, all right?
Okay, all right.
In our English Bibles, we follow another ancient Jewish division, because, you know, Judaism was not totally monolithic. And we divide things into the law, history, poetry and wisdom, and prophets. So the law, five books of Moses. Then history, so Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah, Esther. Those are historical books, right? Then poetry and wisdom. So Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, and then prophets, so Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Lamentations, Daniel, 12 minor prophets. That's how we divide it up. So our last book is Malachi. Traditional Judaism divides it up into Torah, so that's law, five books, that's the same. Prophets, which is Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, because it was believed that all of those books were written by prophets. Then Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets. And then the rest of the writings, that's the third session, which has Job, Psalms, Proverbs. It has books like Ruth and Lamentations and Esther in there. It has Daniel in there. And then it has Ezra and Nehemiah, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and the last book is 2 Chronicles. So the exact same books, different order. If you get from us what's called the Tree of Life Bible, it follows, it has the New Testament also, okay? But it follows the Jewish order. So the order of the books, the number of the books will be different. If you just want to get a Jewish translation that does not have the New Testament at all, okay?
Okay, right.
The best thing is get something called the Tanakh, T-A-N-A-K-H. It's in English. The Tanakh, T-A-N-A-K-H. It is the New Jewish Publication Society version, the new JPS version. You can get online, find it in 2 seconds, or any bookstore over by Bibles, you'll see it. And that's the best translation of the Hebrew Bible into English by Jewish scholars. All right?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure thing. Glad to help. Elwood, 866-34-TRUTH. So just to finish mentioning this, our special resource offer is a thoroughly Jewish resource offer at a great savings. My book, The Real Kosher Jesus, the number one book I've written to give to a Jewish person who wants to find more about Jesus, and the number one book I've written to open Christian eyes to who Jesus, the Jew, really is. That book, together with the mysterious prophecy of Isaiah 53, where Professor Darrell Bach, Professor Michael Redelnik, Professor Walter Kaiser, and yours truly all sit around and discuss and open up that prophecy. And then, lastly, a episode from our Think It Through TV series is Christianity Jewish. So it's two DVDs and the book, just $30, postage paid for everything, and only a few more days to order. So take advantage of it today. Call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, or go to the website, AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org. You'll see it right on the homepage. I trust you'll be richly blessed. We'll be back with your calls.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We go to Reginald in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, Dr. Brown. Thank you for the Line of Fire, Dr. Brown. Yeah, my question is interesting. You were mentioning Isaiah 53 as I was on the phone with the call screener, and I really love the interpretations you were given of the Jewish mindset a while back. So can you give me what the Jewish mindset is on Isaiah 53? What is their interpretation of Isaiah 53?
Yes, sir. The most prominent interpretation known among Jewish people is that it refers to the nation of Israel, or it refers to the righteous remnant within the nation of Israel. So this is the way they would understand it. That when you look earlier in Isaiah, a few chapters back, say starting around chapter 41, you'll see Israel or Jacob referenced as God's servant. And sometimes Israel is an obedient servant. Sometimes Israel is a disobedient servant. Sometimes Israel is a godly servant. Sometimes a blind and deaf servant. But the Jewish view would be this, traditional. It's not the only view, but it's the most common view, that the end of 52 speaks of Israel's great exaltation after tremendous suffering, and that the kings of the earth will be shocked because they have misunderstood who Israel really is. They thought Israel, the Jewish people, were hated and persecuted because of their sins. So they read Isaiah 53 as the words of the foreign kings, not the words of the prophet. So the kings are saying, who would believe our report? Who would believe these things? And looking at Israel, Israel looked like nothing, grew up in lowly circumstances. And then Israel, the Jewish people, scattered around the nations. They suffered terribly. And we, the nations, we thought they were suffering for their sins. We didn't realize they were suffering for our sins and that we were the ones causing their pain and so on. And that ultimately, when Israel is now raised up, it will shock the world and it will bring restoration. Now, the problem, the biggest problem with that, there are several. Aside from the fact that all the language tells us it's the prophet speaking rather than the foreign kings, even so, the only reason Israel was scattered throughout the entire world was because of sin, not obedience. That if Israel as a nation had been obedient to God and righteous, Israel would not have been scattered throughout the world. And yet the servant of the Lord in Isaiah 53 is a righteous servant that has done no violence and there's no corruption on its mouth. So how then could that refer to the people of Israel as a whole? So Others say, no, it's the righteous remnant. Because when Israel sinned, the whole nation suffered. And everybody went into exile, including righteous people. And you see in Psalm 44, this passionate prayer, all this has happened to us, even though we've been faithful to you, God. So who is that praying? That's the righteous remnant that's interceding. saying, God, we've been faithful, and yet all these atrocities have happened to us. How can that be? Well, it's because the nation sinned, but the righteous remnant suffered along with them. So this righteous remnant was not suffering for its sins. Rather, it was being afflicted by the nations. And in every country where the Jewish people were, they were supposed to pray for those nations, and that would bring healing to the nations. That's the way that understanding would be put forth. Then my response to that would be, the problem is it hasn't worked like that. Where we've been scattered for the most part, it's brought judgment. We were scattered in Babylon. We were scattered in Assyria, and those nations are no more. So ultimately, we can demonstrate that it best applies to a person, and that person is the Messiah, who is the ultimate expression of Israel. But here's the thing. It's not like a separate thing. In other words, the Messiah is one with his people. When you win an Olympic medal, they play the national anthem for your country when you stand on the platform. And then you read the headlines, Israel wins medal. Israel wins bronze medal in judo. That's the headline. America wins gold medal in swimming. So Messiah does this for his people. He fulfills the calling and the purpose of Israel. And just as Jewish people have suffered around the world, Messiah has suffered, except we as Jews have suffered because of our sins along with the hatred of the nations, whereas the Messiah only suffered because of the hatred of a sinful world.
Okay, so there's no correlation in the Jewish mindset as the suffering servant, as the Messiah, and the reigning king. That duality, they don't see that, correct?
Here's the only a little. There are some streams of interpretation that do see, and some of the more ancient ones, that do see the end of Isaiah 52 and part of Isaiah 53 speaking about a suffering Messiah. But in Judaism, the suffering Messiah is also a warring Messiah. In Judaism, at the end of the age, many Jews believe that if the Jewish people are not worthy enough, first there'll come the Messiah son of Joseph. And that Messiah son of Joseph will fight the wars of the Lord and be a great general, but then will fall in battle in the final great war. Then the Messiah son of David will raise him from the dead and then finish the work. So the ultimate Messiah that Jewish people are praying for is the Messiah son of David. There are some streams of tradition that see this as a Messiah suffering in heaven, weighted down with the burden of Israel's sin and suffering for Israel. But for the most part, the suffering that is seen in this passage is put on the nation or the righteous remnant within the nation rather than the Messiah. What we need to say is, listen, here's a big circle. That's the nation as a whole. The passage can't rightly apply to them. So make a small circle in the middle. That's the righteous remnant. It fits better, except the righteous remnant did not bring healing to those nations and restoration. So now let's put a dot in the middle of that circle. So right smack dab in the middle of the nation and the people of Israel, it's the righteous remnant of one. It's the Messiah. He alone is the one who has fulfilled that. Hey, Reginald, I've got to run. I am out of time. But, you know, stay right there. Howard, get Reginald's address. Reginald, I want to send you as a gift that DVD on the mysterious prophecy of Isaiah 53. So Howard, get his info. Just want to send that out as a gift to Reginald. To everybody else, here's how you get the DVD. The mysterious prophecy of Isaiah 53. Four of us, biblical professors, opening up the text of Isaiah 53 in a great video put out by Day of Discovery. Plus, the video is Christianity Jewish. These are DVDs. And then my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, all these resources together, what, $50-something value, just $30, postage paid. Call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, or go to AskDrBrown.org. Place your order today. My bottom line, the Messiah of Israel, Jesus, is not outside of the nation. He is the very heart and soul of the nation.